And for this evening's talk, we've got a request which I got from the internet. Someone rather emailed our Buddhist Society, and it's important to be able to give talks here which are not just theoretical, but which address problems of our daily lives, especially some of those big problems. And in the email that someone said that there's a law being contemplated in the UK Parliament concerning euthanasia, and they wanted to have the comments about the Buddhist response to euthanasia. But at the same time, I'm going to also include abortion as well, because those of you who've been reading the newspapers, there's an election here in Western Australia tomorrow, and that's also been a prominently featured in the political discourse. Religion and politics have come together in that area. So many people want to know exactly what is the Buddhist approach to those subjects. So this evening I'm going to be talking about those. So I apologize, there's not going to be so many jokes today, because that would be in bad taste. But nevertheless, these are important topics. And the first thing I'd actually say about this is that as a monk, I was introduced as a spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. But I'm certainly not the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. There's a lot of difference between being a director and being a dictator. A dictator tells you what to do, what to think, what to say. And a director only gives you advice. And this is very true to something very basic in Buddhism. It comes from one of the very well-known sayings from the time of the Buddha, where the Buddha said that Buddhas only show the way, they only point the direction. Every being has to walk that path by themselves. It's a very oft-quoted saying, and the reason is because it is very profound, has many different layers of meaning. And it's always been part of the Buddhist history, that whether it's been a monk, even a senior monk, or a nun, anyone in a position of influence has never been an ultimate authority. Not even the Buddha would do that. He wouldn't say, this is what you should do, follow it or else. There's no equivalent in Buddhism to a pope, or to somebody on high telling people what to do. The whole role of a teacher, and this is what we have, rather than the pope, rather than the priest, like a teacher, a guide. The whole job of a guide is actually to help people make their own decisions, not to make decisions for them. And so Buddhism, it will never have a hard and fast black and white sort of pronouncement on any of these issues. And there's a very important reason for that, because these issues are never black and white. In theory, yes, they're black and white. You shouldn't kill, or it's bad, but when it actually comes to real cases, instances which you have to deal with, then all the black and white, all the rules of the game which you've learned, sometimes just do not apply. Remember, even years ago, one of the Buddhists from, a long-standing Buddhist from our Buddhist society, about 20 years ago, he was diagnosed with having cancer, and he told me, at that time, he'd been meditating and learning all about Buddhism. He thought he knew everything about Buddhism, but as soon as that doctor came and told him he had cancer and probably not long to live, he said all his Buddhism went out the window, and he cried. It was actually showing there that there's a great deal of difference between the theory and a deep understanding. And if all you do is to follow the signposts, Buddhas show the way, follow the signposts, and you don't actually do the walking, you'll find that all these teachings have got hardly any meaning at all. You can't have black and white pronouncements. These are guides. You have to walk that journey for yourself to find out what these things truly mean. So the job of a monk like myself is to give you guidelines, never to tell you what to do, to encourage you to try this, and to look at these particular aspects while you're walking this path and see what happens, to reflect and learn. The whole purpose of life is not just to be faultless and never make a mistake, but to learn about wisdom, about compassion, about life, about truth. It's not to make you faultless, because, as you know, in any school, in life, the school of life, that faults happen, mistakes happen, but it's never any one of the things which impressed me and inspired me in Buddhism from the very beginning. There's never any idea of punishment, not even self-punishment, of guilt. It's always an encouraging. You made a mistake, okay, encourage you to learn from that and see what you can do next. And I think I mentioned that when I made a mistake in Thailand, my teacher Ajahn Chah would never ever punish you. He'd just laugh and think it very funny. I'm not sure if I told a story here recently. The story of me misunderstanding the Thai word for soap. Was that here last week or? Oh, this is, for example, this is an example. Trouble is these days, I travel around so much, I give talks all over the place, I don't know what I said here, what I said somewhere else. This evening I have to go to India to on a leading a pilgrimage, and I come back again. I live a very strange life, but sometimes, for the last couple of months I've been waking up in the morning, the first thing I do, look around and see what country I'm in. Because I was in Sri Lanka just over a week ago, and Malaysia a few days before that. Crazy life as a monk, but anyway, on this particular occasion, this actually gives the idea of like guilt and punishment and forgiveness in Buddhism. The first couple of years as a monk in Thailand, it was a very poor monastery, staying with this great teacher Ajahn Chah, this person I've got no compunction now, no about saying that he was fully enlightened as an arahat. Now he's dead, it's okay to say those things. But at that time, it was a poor monastery. If you needed anything, any requisite, was a toothbrush or toothpaste, or in this particular case, some soap, you go to your teacher and you have this big sort of a little water jar. When people would give him things, he'd put it in there and you could go and ask for things like soap. And so I needed some soap, so I went up to him and I asked him for some soap. Now there's a few Thai people here, they will know the word for soap is sabu. But I said sapo. Only a slight difference, but the thing is, sapo means pineapple. And so I can imagine my teacher now, I can record, he's looking, sapo? And I said, yeah, sapo. He said, what do you want a pineapple for? And I said, to wash myself. And he just burst out laughing. And that was one of his stories for the next couple of days about these Westerners, the different customs in the world. In Thailand they use soap, but in the West, in England, they wash with pineapples. And he thought it was terribly funny. And that was actually typical. He never got punished for making a mistake. It was just a big joke. But you really learn. From that time on, I did learn the difference between soap and pineapple. So there's never any punishment in this Buddhist tradition. And if somebody does make a mistake, the monks don't call you a sinner or you a bad person and excommunicate or do anything to you at all. They just encourage you to learn from your mistakes. So guilt has not got a part in this thing. So that's number one. You show the way. If you make a mistake, never mind, you can learn next time. It does help also in Buddhism. We have this beautiful idea of rebirth or reincarnation. So you've got the time to make mistakes. Isn't that wonderful that you don't have to rush to get enlightened? You don't have to strive so hard to be good. You just take your time, it will work. If not today, tomorrow, if not tomorrow, next month, if not next month, next year, if not next year, next lifetime. Never mind. For those of you who just think, oh, Ajahn Brahm's going on pilgrimage to India, I really want to go to India. If not this time, the next time, if not next time, next life. You'll still be there. The point is, what that does, it gets away this sort of rushing, this stress, I have to do this, I have to do that. And it gets rid of the harshness of an ethical life. You've got time. Especially sometimes you don't have time to do all your housework. But in Buddhism you've got all the time to do your spiritual work. It's huge vistas of time in front of you. And the point is that when you stop rushing, when you're patient, that is the fastest way. Those people who rush towards enlightenment take the longest time. Those who go slowly they're the ones who reach there first. Because this enlightenment business is slowness, peace, stillness. So you can understand why. Those people who are peaceful, who are slow, they're the ones who get there first. So anyway, following that signposts, to actually to understand, first of all, what ethics are. The Buddha actually gave these five signposts, called the five Buddhist precepts. And many of you have taken those five Buddhist precepts, and you know them as not to kill, steal, commit adultery, lie, take alcohol or drugs. But one of the things which again impressed me, and which many of my early teachers pointed out, and it made such a difference to me, and an appreciation of virtue as well. These were not commandments. The Buddha never said, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. He said, I shall refrain from stealing, I shall refrain from killing. It was a more soft approach. You didn't see a person who sort of like killed or went fishing and say, get out of this Buddha society, you're a murderer. You swatted a mosquito, I saw you. There's never any of this like harshness. But these like are guidelines. One of the stories from, again, my early years. There's one of Ajahn Chah's chief supporters. Some of you may have seen many years ago. We still have it in our video cassette library in the reception area. Of this movie called, I think, The Mindful Way, I think it was called. It was a documentary done by the BBC. It must have been about 24 or 5 years ago. Where they visited Ajahn Chah in his monastery in Thailand. They did a documentary about him. And one of the lay people who was figuring in that was a man called Por Am. And he was one of Ajahn Chah's chief disciples. And this is his story. He got faith in this forest monk, but he was a farmer. He was very, very poor. And so he went up to Ajahn Chah one day and said, look, I've heard of these five precepts. You shouldn't kill, steal, commit adultery, lie, and take alcohol or drugs. I would like to keep these, but I have a problem. Now, I have to feed my family, and the only food we have is rice and fish, or you know, other things which crawl on the ground. When I was a young monk in Thailand, that's all you ate. There were no vegetables. The only green things you had were leaves, the young leaves from the mango trees, which tasted awful. That's all you had. It was a subsistence economy, and people just ate rice and whatever sort of moved, basically. And fish was one of the main sources of food. So he said, look, I have to catch fish, you know, for my family. At least he was honest about it, because I know at that time some of the Thai Buddhists, they weren't so honest, and they would actually say that, well, you know, it's not really killing, catching fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. That's what they used to say. But at least, you know, these guys were honest. You can't actually say that. You take them out of the water, you cause their death. So he said, look, what can I do? You know, if I keep those five precepts, my family die. Now this is actually the Buddhist response to these ethical problems. It's very practical, meaningful, and beautiful. Ajahn Chah said, fine, catch fish. Catch enough for you and your family to eat, but not enough to sell. Just enough to get by. In the meantime, Ajahn Chah said, I will teach you another trade. Because as forest monks who used to wander from place to place, one of the things which was part of their upbringing, their learning as a young monk, would be to learn about the herbs and plants in the jungles and forests of Thailand. Because there were no doctors. If you had a fever, whether it's malaria or got bitten by a snake or any other sickness, you would actually know the plants and the herbs in the forest, and you would actually use those to heal yourself. It was the forest monks became the great herbalists. And Ajahn Chah, in his early years, had also learned the different plants and roots which were available in the jungles and what they were, how to prepare them, and what they were good for, and how they could heal this sickness or that sickness. And he was an expert, as many forest monks were. That was just one of the things you learnt in passing. These days, as a monk, a modern monk, especially in Serpentine, what we become experts in these days is not herbalism, but in laying bricks and mixing concrete. If you want some advice on mixing concrete, just ask one of our senior monks. But anyhow, this Ajahn Chah said, okay, I'll teach you everything I know about herbalism. In a matter of 2 or 3 years, he taught this man everything he knew. And so this man now had a new trade. He became the local herbal doctor so he could stop catching fish. He had a way to look after his family. So what Ajahn Chah, this spiritual director, this guide, was saying, said, look, you've got to be practical. You have to catch fish because of your family. But I can help you move towards a greater sense of purity with your precepts. So was it bad that he was catching those fish in those early years? Was that a sin? Was that evil? If it was, Ajahn Chah would never have told him to do it. Because these 5 precepts, they're not absolutes, thou shalt not. They are guidelines. Things we should aspire towards, if it's at all possible. They're never absolutes. Another example of that, which is one which I repeat very often. Many years ago, one of the disciples who, again, a long-standing disciple of our Buddhist society, one of the very earliest members, now he keeps coming to our Armadale group every so often. He's very, very old, in his, I don't know, 80s or something now, but still wanders in every now and again. About 10 or 12 years ago, he had a heart attack. He went to Royal Perth Hospital. They managed to save his life, to keep him going. But he needed a bypass. So he was put on the emergency list for the bypass. They kept him in hospital. The next time there was an opportunity, he would be there having his bypass. He was in a room with three other people. And I went to visit him several times. When he had his bypass operation, the day before his bypass operation, his wife visited him and after the visit called me up at Serpentine Monastery. She was very agitated. It's the first and only time she's actually called me. And she said, something happened, I want your advice. This is an English couple. She said that I've just lied to my husband for the first time in 30 years. And she felt so bad about this, as you probably would. So what have you done? What happened? And she said that what happened was, in that ward, in the next bed, was a fellow called Jack or something, who was, it's a ward, everyone in that ward was waiting for the bypass. You know, they put people with the same ailments in the same wards. And he said he got a friendship up with this Jack, being in the same room 24 hours a day for 3 or 4 days. And Jack was going to have this bypass operation the day before him. Jack had already had the bypass operation. He asked his wife, how had Jack done? And his wife said, fine, he's now in the ICU recovering. But that was a lie, said his wife, because the truth was that Jack died in the operation. Because she met his relations outside. And she said, I didn't really feel I could tell my husband that. He was so sick and weak anyway, that if I had told my husband that his friend had died of the very operation he's going to have tomorrow, I thought that might make my husband so afraid it might actually push him over the edge and kill him. And as it happened, that he was on the edge of life and death for several days, hallucinating, and they managed to keep him going. It was a touch and go because he was very old when he had his bypass operation. And I told the wife, okay, in that particular instance, you did the right thing to lie to your husband. I said that. And when people say to me, are you saying, Ajahn Brahm, it's okay to lie? I say, yeah, once every 30 years, but no more. Because these are guidelines. And guidelines, the best simile which we can use to understand what is actually a guideline? Because similes, we have to get something from our ordinary daily life to understand why, what's going on here. And one of the best similes to understand the meaning of all this is a simile of the red traffic lights. And the red traffic lights, you have to stop. It's against the law to go through them. It's against the precepts of our government. But, do you know exceptions when it's okay to go through red traffic lights? Of course, if you get a heart attack and somebody puts you in the car and they drive you to the nearest emergency department, I'd hope you go through the red traffic lights. But how do you go through them? You get to that red traffic light, and you'd be careful. You'd stop. It's a warning. And you'd look. If it was safe and it was an emergency, you'd go through. Because that could save a person's life. And no policeman would prosecute you for that. I know sort of one of the disciples in Armidale, saw them a couple of days ago. Their partner had a heart attack, and they rushed them, put them in the car and rushed them to the Armidale Kelmscott Hospital. And he went through every red light she could find, and she was so disappointed there was no police car around to see her. At last I could go through a red light, she said, and no policeman could stop her. I never saw a policeman. But the point was that that's an occasion, I think no one would argue, the police wouldn't argue, the law wouldn't argue, that's an emergency, that's a time to go through the red light. An emergency, and it's safe. And that's actually how we look at these five precepts of the Buddha. These are rules. When you come to that, breaking a precept, like that lady lying to her husband, red light, stop. Is it really safe? Isn't it an emergency? It's a special situation. If it is, then go across. It's very rare that you have to do that, but sometimes you do. That's why these rules will never be black and white. And that's why you can only have guidelines. How do you make those decisions? Not what the answer will be, but how to make those decisions. So when it gets to something like euthanasia, how do we make those decisions? I think many of you would know that the first person in the world to have legal euthanasia, a Mr. Dent from Darwin, was a Buddhist. I never met him myself, but those of you who know Ajahn Yan, and by the way, he's coming to visit from the 3rd to the 10th of April. Some people call him Ajahn Smiley. But he's coming soon. He went to visit him in Royal Perth, because he came down for some treatment, and talked about his situation and what was going on. And we all knew in our monastery what was going on. That this man, Mr. Dent, was the first person for legally assisted euthanasia, and it was not because of his own sickness. The major reason why he chose to have assisted euthanasia was, or assisted suicide, was because of his concern for his wife. His disease, whatever, had no possibility of any cure. It could last for many years. He was quite willing to tolerate the discomfort and pain. Despite all the palliative care, there was still a lot of discomfort and pain. Palliative care is not perfect, as many people know. It was not his pain. He was actually looking at his wife, who had to give him 24 hours of care and had no life of her own. He said that was the main reason he decided to take assisted euthanasia, to give his wife freedom. Can you argue against that? In real cases, when you actually talk to a person, listen to the situation, there's something inside of you say, well, it's killing, yeah, it's a red traffic light, but maybe this is one of those occasions when it is okay to go across. And this is something which I've always, as a monk, because I have to help people in these situations. It's not theory for me. And sometimes people come and say, you know, my wife, my husband, my grandparents are sort of in hospital. Should I turn off the machine? You know, because they're asking me, should I do this? What should I do? Or even abortion. People come up and ask me, you know, so I've got an unwanted pregnancy or a difficult pregnancy. What should I do? Sometimes people think that monks don't live in the real world. But sometimes that actually we face problems which, you know, sometimes you only face once. I face them many, many times. So I live life on the edge. And there's many, many times when I've either been confronted with this personally, or that you've read about it, or people have talked about it. There's something inside you feel, you did the right thing, that's right. And sometimes before there's a bit of a conflict, because in my guts, as it were, I think this is, I would have done the same thing. But sometimes before I read these five precepts, you're not supposed to kill. And there's like a conflict on, you know, between how I felt and the words in the book. And these days, because of maybe Buddhism, How you feel inside is more important than the words in the book. The words in the book are supposed to actually to reflect how you feel inside. How you feel inside, that's the main thing. Because why is it that there is a law being contemplated in the UK to actually to allow assisted euthanasia? It is because that many people feel in their guts, or they've had experience in this, and they think it's the right, compassionate thing to do. And that should not be discounted, one's inner feelings. Because that's usually a much better indicator of truth than anything which can be written in a book. What you write in books is approximations. I don't know if there's any Christians here, but if you believe in God's word will be in your guts, not in a book. You find out truth from inside, because it doesn't feel right, or it feels good. And so that there is a reason why this is being discussed now, because there are sometimes some cases where people feel it's the right thing to do. And so because of that, what the Buddhist answer is we can give you guidelines to find out which are those exceptional cases where it probably will be the proper thing to do, while many cases it's not the right thing to do. And so in order to find out what is the right thing, what is the wrong thing to do, we have these guidelines. It's a red traffic light. You should not do this very easily to assist suicide. Red traffic light, stop. And the next thing is when you're making these choices, the Buddha actually gave this wonderful help when you're in a position of authority. You've got authority over your body, or if you're a mother, over your child. As a monk, you've got some sort of decision-making to do from time to time. How to make decisions. This is actually, he said, a matrix, like a four things you should consider when you're making decisions. It's called the four agati, he called it. So when you're making decisions, see if you're making it, first of all, from desire, from personal desire, from wanting, getting something out of this for yourself, from selfishness, from craving. Is this, just because, you want the easy way out? Or, you want to get something out of it? Are you advising sort of euthanasia, for your husband so he can go and get married to somebody else? Or are you advising euthanasia so you can go and inherit something? I just was laughing last week because sometimes you go, when people are sick, sometimes they go and ask the monk to do some chanting. We're very good at this chanting. And I've got a lot of faith in Buddhist chanting, just it extends people's lives. I think I said this last week. We've got a cat at our monastery. It's over 18 years of age, which is a long age for a cat. And people say, and look at it, it's really healthy. Runs around like a young cat kitten. Why can it do that? Why has that cat had a long life? It's the same reason why those of you who've been coming to our monastery in Serpentine often, you will have noticed a strange thing. It's been a long time since any core member of our Buddhist society has died. We've kept you alive for the last, 18, 20 years. I literally can't remember the last person, a core member of our Buddhist society, comes regularly, who's actually passed away. And the reason is, you get all this chanting every week, and same as the cat. The cat gets a chanting every day. No wonder it's living to a ripe old age. But the trouble is that sometimes, I remember going to one of the hospitals, I forget which one, and doing some chanting for this poor, I think, man or lady who was about to pass away. And the relations afterwards told me off. They say he was about to die, now he's starting to get better again. And so, it's time for him to go. Don't do any more chanting, please. I don't know if they wanted the will or something, but he'd be in and out of hospital or whatever. And sometimes when it's, even you love the person, it's time for them to go. They've got no quality of life, so you want to let them go. But so sometimes we want to let them go, and we actually say sometimes to let nature take its course. Have you ever heard that phrase? Let nature take its course? Aren't we part of nature? It's amazing, isn't it? Sometimes we talk about let nature take its course. We take ourselves out of nature as if we're something separate. But we're nature as well. Isn't part of nature to care? to be kind. To let nature take its course. We're part of nature. Let compassion take its course as well. And I can actually see a bigger picture there. Let nature take its course. You see someone who's got no quality of life at all. No other alternatives. Is it time to just turn off the machine? You're letting your compassion, which is part of nature, take its course. Interesting idea, isn't it? The whole point of Buddhism is actually opening up more avenues, more ways of seeing these things. I'm not telling you what to do, but telling you how to make those decisions. So make sure it's not out of craving or desire. Also, not out of ill will. You want to get rid of that person. And also, not out of stupidity. Stupidity is when you haven't got all the information. So whenever you're contemplating or in a position like that, you've got to get as much information as you possibly can to make a wise decision. Has that person got any possibility of surviving? Is there any other treatments? Is it really worthwhile? And it's some amazing cases. Like sometimes, there's one of the women I know very well in Singapore, and she's told her story a couple of times in my presence, and I've actually repeated her story. She was one of these people in a coma, completely out of it. The doctors thought she was gone. And so they asked her children, who were by the bedside, your mother's got no chance of surviving, she's basically dead, shall we turn off the machine? But she was listening at the time. She told the story that she... It's an interesting story. As she experienced it herself, she went to this very, very dark and black place. You know, where everything was just dark, she couldn't see, hear, feel anything. Doesn't know for how long. What brought her back? She said she heard some temple gongs. Being a Buddhist from Singapore, Chinese Buddhist, in the far, far distance, she heard these temple gongs. And that was brought her back into consciousness and then into her body. And when she was back in her body, she could feel, she could hear, she could even see. But she couldn't talk back. She couldn't tell the people around her that she was back, that she could hear them or see them. And she said she was in this frightening situation. You know, she was could see her sons, her daughters, her friends. She could hear them, but she couldn't respond at all. It was a one-way communication. In, but she couldn't communicate back again. So they thought she was dead, just on a machine. She couldn't move her eyes, she couldn't move anything. And then the doctor was talking to her sons, there's no chance for your mother, but I need your permission to turn off the machine. Shall we turn off the machine? And she was listening to this as it was happening. Imagine what it was like. And being a Chinese family, and being all cowards, they said, it's the senior son, the eldest son's job, you decide. They put all of the responsibility on this one boy. He said, I can't make this decision by myself. It's your decision, because we can't make it. So this young man had to make the decision. And this woman said, at the time, she was just willing with everything she had, please don't turn it off, I'm still here. Please, please, please. And it was just, no. Very, very, you know, it's like the biggest exam of your life. And just imagine how nervous you would be when someone held your life and death in their hands. And her son thought for a while and said, give her another day. And, thank you, son, she thought. And by the end of the next 24 hours, she could move slightly. And that first movement, they realized then, you know, she was coming back. And so, you know, they never switched the machine off. And so she came back and she started the whole journey of lots of physiotherapy, learning how to walk again, speak again, and now you would never distinguish her from just an ordinary elderly lady. Come back again to life. It's an interesting situation that, and there's many other cases like it, that sometimes you don't know the truth. Sometimes the doctors make mistakes as well. They think a person's gone, but they're not. So how can you find out if that's your situation? They say, shall we turn off the machine or not? What would you do? As a Buddhist, or as just a spiritual person, this is what you should do. Listen. Make your mind still and peaceful. and listen with everything you've got, mind to mind. I'm sure actually that's why that son said, keep her going for a day. She was actually trying to communicate with him. That was her son. There has to be a connection between mothers and son, close relations or close friends. Work on that connection. Feel. Get away all the thoughts and the worries and all this sort of stuff, which stops you being sensitive. Stop all this idea of rules business. This is what I should do, that's what I should do. Because that blocks out you being sensitive to the situation. Just like you come to the red traffic light. Look backwards and forwards very carefully to see if there's any danger. And when you're really sensitive like that, you'll know what to do. And you can trust that. It feels good, it feels right, and 99.9% of the time, it will be right. My saying is, always follow your guts, unless you've got stomachache. So this is actually how we make the decision. The last thing, so not ignorance, in other words, get all the information, but be that wisdom from silence. And the last thing, never act out of fear. These are the four things you should never act out of. You should check whenever you're making a decision. Don't act of desire, ill will, stupidity and fear. And one of the problems with religions, I must say, or laws, it just adds this ingredient of fear into our decision making. Oh, I'm going to go to hell if I sort of turn off the machine or don't turn off the machine. People are going to criticize me. They're going to shout at me. If I do these things, they're going to reject me. And that fear business sometimes just messes up decision making, especially ethical decisions, which are on the edge of right and wrong, and confuses the issue so much, which is one of the reasons why inside of me, I don't want law to get involved in these decisions, because it just adds a fear into it, the fear of going to court and being fined or sent to prison, because the legalities of it create fear. Obviously, the law has a part to play, but it should, in those very grey areas of right and wrong, because some people will argue. They wouldn't be arguing about it if it was black and white. It's a grey area, and sometimes the law should butt out of those grey areas and give people the confidence to make their own decision, the support to make a good decision, almost getting rid of those things which make people make the wrong decisions, such as fear. And to know that whatever decision you make, as long as it's done rationally, not desire, no ill will, no delusion, no fear, to know when you make that decision you won't be punished. If you make the wrong decision, you learn from it. You won't be punished, but you'll be encouraged, you'll be helped with compassion to deal with the aftermath of that decision. Because this is what happens sometimes with abortions. It's a very difficult decision to make for a woman. And in the end, that woman will make that decision. Even if it's against the law, we all know that there's the old backstreet abortions in the old days. A decision will have to be made. We want to help the person make the decision wisely. When it comes actually to the abortion end of the argument, yeah, it is wrong to kill, and the fetus in the womb is a sort of being. But interesting, for those who want to know that the Buddhist idea, because we have this idea of rebirth, what actually happens? There's heaps and heaps of evidence to rebirth. And I take it as a fact. I know it's true. I don't mind going on the video. Rebirth is true. It's a fact. When you understand rebirth, it gives the whole picture of abortion and euthanasia, life and death, a completely different perspective. And what actually happens is the being from the previous life, we call it the stream of consciousness, it comes into the mother's womb at a certain time. And that time can be just after the implantation in the uterus, or it can be much later. According to the evidence, the stats, if you like, from people who can remember their past lives, sometimes even a few days before birth. the new stream of consciousness can come into that mother's womb, into the fetus. And until that time, until the separate consciousness literally sort of descends into that womb, which is how the Buddha called it, then that fetus is literally just a part of the mother. It is, you know, part of her body. It is not a separate being. It's only when the new stream of consciousness comes in there that it does become an independent, separate being, as, although still very much connected to the mother, but separate. So according to the, you know, theology, if you like, of Buddhism, the metaphysics of it, you can't really tell sometimes whether killing the fetus is actually killing a new being, or actually just, you know, same as like having some part of a woman's body cut out, whether it's a being or it's part of the mother. That's why it's so difficult actually to say whether it is killing or just cutting out a tumour. I'm not just being glib here, this is actually what happens. But we always, because we don't know, we should never kill. However, in such a situation that, you know, as many people have the experience, they've had an abortion, and they want to know what happens afterwards. And there was very recently in the Armadale group, a lady asked this question. She's here this evening. I saw her earlier. Please excuse me. I think you don't mind me sharing this piece of advice. She felt very upset about it for many years, as many women would do. So she asked my advice, and what's happening there? And one thing which I mentioned to her, and this again is part of the truth of rebirth, because one of the questions I asked her, did you have any children later? And she had another child shortly later. And I said that this is actually what happens. The being wants to come into your womb. You've got some karma with you. And very often that we take rebirth in people we know. In sort of, you know, our friends, our relations, someone we've got some connection with. In tales of rebirth, very often people get reborn in the same family. Because if you've got like a wife, a sister, a mother you really, really love, that sort of connection, that bond, you can feel that bond. That will actually go off into your next life and you'll be attracted into that person again, or attracted close to them again. So you can meet again, you can be with each other again. So I said, that being who tried to get in your womb once, they'll probably try again. And I said to her that, look, your second child, or the child you had after that abortion, is 99% sure that was a being that you couldn't make it the first time. Imagine the response of that woman to that answer was actually just so helpful. Because in an abortion we think we're cutting off that person, they got no chance of a life. That, you know, they had this opportunity to come into this life and it's all been ruined and killed. In religions or philosophies which think you only have one life, then of course, you know, this human life becomes so important, so precious. It makes a whole ethical judgment a completely different ball game. But, you know, with Buddhism, Hinduism, and any other religion which understands the truth of rebirth, it becomes a completely different ball game, as they say. And that was a good example there. The being, they didn't make it the first time, but they had another chance, and they came into your womb, and you finished your pregnancy and gave birth to this boy. And that was almost certainly the person who was there before. The reason I say this is because this is old custom, in Thailand especially. When a child dies, either from a miscarriage or is stillborn, they put a mark on their body. This happened here, I don't think they're here this evening, the supporters of this temple, this Thai couple whose first child died just a day or two before it was born. You know what happens, the fetus had an ultrasound a few days before, it turned in the womb, strangled itself with the umbilical cord, so it was stillborn. They told me that at the funeral service, which I conducted, just up the road in Wanneroo Road, just while the funeral director, when I wasn't watching, with a ballpoint pen, they made a mark on the heel. Just a line. And then it was cremated. And a few months later, she became pregnant again. And when the baby was born, they found it had a birthmark, a line on the heel exactly where they put it before. It's an old custom. The being who tried and just failed at the last step just before birth had had another go. Second time lucky. The same as that woman who had an abortion. Second time lucky. When you put it that way, some of the sting of abortion actually is taken away. A being is trying to get into this world. They try once, they may try again. If they don't make it with you, they make it with something else. It's a different ball game. And of course, in such situations that I'm not a man. Most religions are run by men. And I can't actually say to anybody, that's right, that's wrong. You can just help people make the decisions. To certainly try not to act out of ill will or craving, desire. You know, just because it's easy for you not to have that child. Not to act out of stupidity. You know, find out exactly what's going on, what the possibilities are for looking after that child, getting support, having it adopted or whatever. And certainly not out of fear. No, whatever decision you make, you'll always get support. So when somebody rings me up and asks me, sort of, you know, I'm pregnant, but you know, for one reason or another, I just can't have that child. And they ask me that advice. This is the advice I give them as a Buddhist leader. So I can't tell you, and I will not tell you, what to do. But I can help you make your decision. And whatever decision you make, compassion will always be there for you. Because I know just how difficult it must be. I don't really know how difficult it is, but I can empathize how difficult it must be. I'm saying that I'll always support you, whichever way you do. No matter what you do, you'll always be allowed in here as a friend. If you made a mistake, if it is really wrong, you feel it inside. Not as guilt, because sometimes we feel guilty. It's not that we know it's a mistake, we think that everyone else says it's a mistake. You know, that sort of religious leaders or the law says it's wrong, but you feel, no, it's right inside, and we have this conflict between what we're told and what we really understand inside of us. In such a case, believe what's inside of you. But a lot of times there's still some little pain there, and the response from Buddhists or anybody is to support, to be compassionate. You made a mistake, allow people to make mistakes so they can learn, so they can grow into being more compassionate, and especially with, you know, with abortion. You know, how did that child get into your womb in the first place? Be a bit more careful next time, if at all possible. You know, that's the real mistake there. So learn from the mistake, so you don't have to go through that again. But if you think that being has been deprived of a life, they'll come back again. They tried it once, they'll try again. And they maybe come back the next time. So you're not denying them a life. You're just delaying the life. It's like this evening, I'm supposed to go off to India on a pilgrimage. I don't know that I've heard from my disciples in Singapore, work for Singapore Airlines. Sometimes the Singapore Airlines overbook the flight. And you could turn up at the airport and you find that there's no seats for you, even if you've got your ticket. You get bumped off. Very similar to an abortion. They even use the same word to bump someone off is to kill them. But, you know, if that happens, you usually get on the next flight. If you wish another being sort of a better life as a result of such action, it's the other beings come. You just can't sort of, you know, just give them that sort of that pass. It's not up to you. It's really up to them. So, but, you know, you can wish them well. That's maybe as much as one can do. But the whole purpose of this talk this evening is actually to see that in many cases, not in all cases, that the ethics there is so complex, it's hard to give black and white decisions. And I see in the newspaper people fulminating about abortion is wrong. No, you should give women choice. No, euthanasia is always wrong. It's an evil, it's a sin and stuff like that. And that sort of just makes the whole discussion just so complicated, and it just muddies the water. It's not compassionate, it's not wise. It's certainly nothing to do with Buddhism. And the Buddhist response, you may think this is a bit wishy-washy, but we're on grey areas here. Buddhas only show the way. The five precepts are a guideline. There are exceptions to every rule. Rules are man-made. I was going to say woman-made, but they're usually man-made. Except in the kitchen. The kitchen rules are woman-made. And, well, it was Margaret Thatcher. She made a few rules, so I suppose that's one exception there. And if you want to trust the heart, and that's usually the best indicator of what's right and wrong. And the point is to be able to trust that heart. Make sure you're never working from these like four agatis, not desire, ill will, stupidity or fear. And so get all the information and get some support. So when you're in a position, this is not a theory anymore, it's not where you're going to vote this is in law or not, this is actually reality. You have to make a decision. It's you or your loved one who's at stake here, or it's your baby in your womb. When it's a real decision, not some theory, this is how you make those decisions. The guidelines are there. It's a red light. Usually killing is wrong. 99.999% of the time it's wrong. It's the wrong thing to do. But there's those exceptions, those rare cases. You have to know how to make those decisions. Stop at that red light, see if it's safe, and I've helped you understand to see if it's safe, and only if it's an emergency and it's safe, then go across. You feel in your heart that this is the right thing to do. And that's why the Buddha said, karma. And this is what we're talking about here, this is the Buddhist ethics. He said the karma, the most important ingredient in karma is intention. What do you mean by this? What's its purpose? And there's a beautiful saying of the Buddha. Karma is basically intention. What did you mean? And if you really meant it's compassion and kindness, you really thought it was a good idea at the time, and you weren't just heedless, you got the information, you considered carefully, no desire, no ill will, no fear, and you really think this is the most compassionate thing to do. It was selfless, it was caring, like that Mr. Dent. Then you can't blame it. In the time of the Buddha, there were some people who did commit suicide. These were arahats, fully enlightened beings. In that case, the Buddha said, those suicides were blameless. He did show there were exceptions to those rules. Rare exceptions, but exceptions were there. So in this euthanasia debate, in this abortion debate, we should have those guidelines. The law should be there for the obvious cases where it's obviously wrong. But in those areas, those grey areas, I think that we need support, not laws. We need guidelines rather than hard and fast rules. And I think that we should be compassionate and helpful rather than dogmatic and cruel. And when people make mistakes in such areas, it's a completely different thing than they say, like to kill your wife with a kitchen knife, than actually to ask the people to turn off the machines or have assisted euthanasia. It's a completely different ball game. It's not murder, not in the same sense of murdering someone, who you don't like. You feel that, you know that, and so we shouldn't use those terms. And this is how you can make those decisions. And you can live with them, learn by them, become a better person because of them, and help other people at the same time. Euthanasia is a Greek word meaning a good death. Interesting that that is the word which is used for assisted suicide, a good death. I'll leave you to think about that. Thank you. Okay, any questions about that topic? Yeah, go on.
Mm-hmm.
Very good, yeah. It's sometimes, I should repeat the question. You're saying that it's not an easy decision, say, for a woman to make about an abortion. It's not an easy decision for a person to make on euthanasia also. And it's a traumatic decision for the woman. It's a traumatic decision for all concerned, even in a euthanasia. And to the politicians, they can be dogmatic on that issue, but then it seems to be that it's a bit of hypocrisy that we can actually send people to war. And our society does condone killing in certain situations, self-defense, and that self-defense is used as an excuse for sending people to war, preemptive strikes and stuff like that. And so that, you know, the most, even our politicians and the law and even sort of all theologians, you know, they have this idea of a just war. That was Aquinas, I think, who started that. So, you know, they say in some situations there is exceptions to the rule. You know, thou shalt not kill. We know there's exceptions. And actually we should actually also understand there are exceptions in other places as well. You know, with euthanasia and with abortion. But with the idea, with the comment that the decisions are very traumatic, they are traumatic and part of the law, a government, human beings, especially religious leaders, is trying to take away that trauma. Because a lot of the trauma comes because of what society imposes upon the person making the decision. If a lot of people come and say, that's wrong, that's evil, you go to hell, you're a terrible person, you've murdered your child. When people actually take that on board and they're easily influenced, of course, what does that feel? If you've been in an abortion clinic for one reason or another, you've done that and you come out and these protesters start calling you murderer. And of course that adds to the trauma. It's not a compassionate and a helpful thing to do. And I think that if we have a wiser, more compassionate way of dealing with those problems, one of the things would actually ease the trauma of people having to make those decisions. And part of the reason for the talk is to ease that trauma. That's part of my job, not to make the decision, to help you make the decision, and to ease, take away as much trauma as possible by saying it's okay to make a mistake. If it was a mistake, I don't know. If you have made a mistake, it's okay to make it. You're not going to go to hell for it. Learn from that mistake. As you've heard me say before, this AFL code, acknowledge, forgive, learn. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. Don't sort of deny it and say, I didn't do this, or someone else did it, or I didn't have much choice about it. You did have the choice. Acknowledge, but forgive, and learn from it. No guilt, no punishment, and learn to be a good person. So yeah, that's true. I fully agree with what you said. Did that sort of answer the question? Okay. Any other comments about this topic? You may not agree with actually the answers which I give, and again, I'm not the spiritual dictator, I'm a director. So you're very welcome if you disagree with me. But the point is, the purpose of this talk was not to tell you what to do, but to show you how decisions are made, and how religion should be helping you, rather than telling you what to do. Buddha showed the way, it's up to you to walk. Showing a path, for you to find out for yourself. And so your life is that learning experience. But to know that you've always got friends on their journey. And whatever you decide to do, I will always be your friend. So there's a talk for this evening. So thanks very much for listening.